like this with human beings. We may look similar, but inside of us, each has its own unique personality, and so on. My point is that the factor X, this plastic toy in the middle of us, does not only guarantee the underlying identity of different subjects, but also the continuing identity of the same subject. 20 years ago, National Geographic, the magazine, published, you probably remember it, the famous photo of a young Afghani woman with fierce, bright yellow eyes. In 2001, after the Afghani war, the same woman was identified. She was found. Although her face was changed, worn out from difficult life and heavy work, her intense eyes were instantly recognizable as the factor of continuity. Now, that was exploited. Like, the eyes are the same, you can immediately see. But here, I think we shouldn't be so naive. I remember how 2 decades ago, even more, Stern, the German weekly journal, made a rather cruel experiment. It paid a couple of destitute homeless men and women who then allowed themselves to be thoroughly washed, shaved, and then delivered to the top designers and hairdressers. In one of its issues, Stern then published 2 parallel large photos of each person. First, on the left side, in his or her destitute homeless habit, dirty, unshaved, and so on. Then, on the other side, shaved, dressed by a top designer. And the result was effectively uncanny, horrifying. Although it was clear that we are dealing with the same person, the effect of the different dress and so on was that this belief of ours that beneath the different appearance there is one and the same person was shaken. It is not only the appearance which was different. The deeply disturbing effect was that we somehow perceived a different personality beneath the appearance. So this is again what makes for me problematic this logic of plastic toy. I mean, I am for universalism, but it has to be formulated in a different way. I think that a direct reference to a plastic toy which beneath all appearances makes us the same is misleading. It's maybe at the theoretical level one of the aspects of what is wrong, so I think, with liberal ideology. So now I come to the concluding part. So what is wrong with the predominant liberal ideology? The best indicator of it is maybe the sincere horror expressed by, usually by liberals, apropos overt, open racist excesses. Recall the well-known true story, it was told to me recently at a conference, of how, a century ago, the ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court defined as Negro, black, anyone with even a minimum of the African-American blood. Well, if only a 64th tile of your ancestry was black, it was enough even if you looked totally white. Now, what is wrong with the passionate retelling of these stories? It was told to me with a passion by a liberal. You see, we were horrible Americans. You see, if only one, with only a 64th tile of your ancestry was black, isn't this horrible? It is horrible, but precisely when you hear these exclamations, like, you see, this was even worse than Nazis, for whom you were counted as Jewish only if 1/4 or more of your ancestry was Jewish. The problem for me is that the very focus on the excess renders acceptable a more moderate form of the racist exclusion. In other words, the role of such excesses, the moral indignation that gives rise to them, is exactly the same as today's indignation felt by good liberal Democrats when they are confronted with violent, overtly racist populism. For example, in France, which is why I'm not so glad about Chirac's victory against Le Pen. You should just read closely how this victory came about. Of course, the official reaction was horror. All France should unite against Le Pen. Horrible, how dark, how uncivilized, unacceptable, and so on. But then, of course, the logic was, they were always followed, such statements, by a more ominous statement, which was, but nonetheless, we should see how Le Pen is manipulating, but nonetheless addressing the true worries of the people, and so on and so on. So I think, again, that this horror at Le Pen was basically hypocritical. It was a kind of a rationalization to accept even Le Pen in, to endorse, to apply his problematic, his measures, in, of course, in a much more civilized way. The opposite of Le Pen is horrible is not we reject his problematic, but we will address his issues in a more civilized way. And that's what I see as rather sad going on in the last decades in the West. Facts like this gives us a clear indication of what the left was doing in the last decades. Ruthlessly pursuing the path of giving way, of accommodating itself, of making the so-called necessary compromises with the declared enemy, by way of reconciling the opposites. For example, the left stands for socialism, but in England can fully endorse economic thatcherism. It stands for science, but can fully endorse the rule of the multitude of opinions. It stands for true democracy, but can also play the game of politics as spectacle and electoral spins. It stands for principle fidelity, but can be totally pragmatic. It stands for freedom of the press, but can flatter and get the support in England, in United Kingdom of Murdoch, and so on and so on. What does this mean? In the old days of the 20th century, great conservatives often did the tough job for the liberals. After the confused attitude of the social government in France, which generated the global crisis of the French Republic in the late 50s, it was General de Gaulle who cut the Gordian knot by giving Algeria independence. Even later in the United States, it was Nixon who established diplomatic relations with China. Today, I think the opposite scenario is almost the rule. The new third way left does the job for economic conservative liberals, dismantling the welfare state, bringing privatization to the end, and so on and so on. In his brilliant analysis of the political confusion of the French Revolution of 1848, Marx pointed out the paradoxical status of the ruling party of the order. It was the coalition of the two royalist wings, Bourbons and Orleanists. However, since the two parties were by definition not able to find a common denominator at the level of royalism, you cannot be royalist in general, you have to be for one house, they were only able to unite under the banner of what Marx calls the anonymous kingdom of republic. The only way to be royalist in general is to be republican. And mutatis mutandis is not something similar going on today. As we all know, capital is today split into two main factions, the traditional industrial capital and the postmodern digital informational and so on capital. And the only way for the two factions to find a common denominator is under the banner of the anonymous capitalism of social democracy. Today, the only way to be a capitalist in general is to be a third-way social democrat. And I claim this is how the opposition left-right works today, even as far as I'm informed in Israel here. It is the new third-way left which stands for the interest of the capital as such, in its totality. That is to say, in the relative independence from its particular factions. While today's right, as a rule, advocates the interests of some particular faction of the capital in contrast to other factions. Which is why, in order to get the majority, it is the right which has to argue, which in order to augment its electoral base, has to appeal directly also to selected parts, usually ours against foreigners, of the working class. Which is why, interestingly enough, it's in today's right-wing parties that you find much more direct appeal to the working class than in this third-way modern left. However, it's easy to say this, but we should nonetheless ask a more radical, hard question. Was there an alternative? I mean, from what I just said, I don't conclude. I'm not a naive old leftist who thinks, oh, everything would be much better if only Blair or Schroeder would not betray the old social democratic left. No, there is a problem. A problem is what? And with this I will conclude. I perceive in you some, I project in you some superego.
I'm so glad you got to such interesting ideas at the end. So this keeps.
Okay, then I hear, because that's the logic of, you know, American commercial TV, like you have to keep to the end and then. Okay, and then I will do at the end what on American miniseries happens. At the end you will get just, I will have to cut off and then, you know, the previews of what comes next week and so on. Okay, So my point is what I already said, and with this I will conclude that, you know, we all celebrate the disintegration of state socialism 2 decades ago. But let's not forget that at approximately the same time, the Western social democratic welfare state ideology was also dealt a crucial blow. That it also ceased to function as the imaginary which is able to arouse collective passionate following. It's today commonly accepted, the fact that, as they put it, the time of the welfare state has passed. Now what these two defeated ideologies share is the notion that humanity as a collective subject has the capacity to somehow limit the impersonal, anonymous, historic development, to steer it in a desired direction. Today, such a notion is quickly dismissed as ideological or totalitarian. The social process is today again perceived as dominated by anonymous fate beyond social control. The rise of global capitalism is presented to us as such a fate. You cannot fight it. You either adapt yourself to it or you lose. You are crushed. You are out. My idea is that, which is why today to be a leftist it's much more difficult than it appears. It means something much more radical. It means that we will have to literally reinvent the entire field. I mean, you cannot be a leftist by accepting the way the universal picture is presented to you, and then we want a little bit more of this, a little bit more of that, and so on and so on. I think we will have to attack, to undermine directly the fetishes, for example, the fetish of growth, and so on and so on. I think that this would be something, when people ask me what would be a true breakthrough for the left today, something totally crazy, like to have a government which would promise its electorship to lower the growth rate, to say, no, we can guarantee you that economy will decrease, will fall. Something along those lines will have to be done. But let me now truly conclude by returning to the topic of September 12th, September 11th. What worries me is that within this ideological hegemony, the trends, what I mean by the trends? You saw, probably some of you, or at least you know the story of Steven Spielberg's last film, Minority Report. There, the story, based on a Philip Dick short story, the narrative is that criminals are arrested even before they commit their crime, since 3 humans who, through some monstrous scientific experiments, acquired the capacity to foresee the future, they can predict their acts. And the Minority Report is when some of them do not agree. You know, the idea is that you are arrested minutes before you commit the crime. Like, they inform you in half an hour you will perform that murder, so to prevent it, we will arrest you. Sounds nice, but my association was here. What we get now in the United States with so-called Bush, or rather Dick Cheney doctrine, this idea that United States have the right to preemptive strikes, not even if the threat is already imminent, but even they have the right to intervene even before. Are they not realizing the same logic of the Minority Report of the film at the level of the relationship between the states? So my ironic note here would have been that when Gerhard Schroeder opposed the military intervention in Iraq, he literally wrote in the precise sense of the film a Minority Report. This was a Minority Report. Yeah, no? So this logic of Bush doctrine is, I think, what happened on September 12th, to put it in these terms. And why? Why do I consider it relatively dangerous? Terry Eagleton, in his last book, drew attention to the fact that there are two opposed modes of tragedy. On the one hand, we have the big, spectacular, catastrophic event, the abrupt eruption from some other world. This is the big catastrophe. Like September 11th was this kind of catastrophe. No, we live our peaceful life, something explodes. But then, mostly in the third world countries, we have another type of tragedy, the continuous tragedy, the dreary persistence of a hopeless condition, a horrifying existence which goes on indefinitely. Life as one long emergency state. And what I claim is that the first mode of tragedy, the figure is in a way, the figure against the normal background is characteristic of the first world, and it usually functions as a catastrophic figure which makes us aware of the blissful background of our happiness, of the necessity to defend ourselves against the foreigner's onslaught. In this sense, and this seems to me the tragedy of September the 12th, is that usually what we hear about September 11th is that it was the moment of awakening. No? The idea is, under the Clinton years were the years of false liberal hopes. Now America has to awaken to recognize that we have real enemies, there is still a battle to be won, and so on and so on. My thesis is exactly the opposite. The function of September 11th was to put American ideology, to put them to sleep again. What do I mean by this? If anything, it is from after the Vietnam, from the years of Vietnam, that the American ideology was half awakened. By this I mean was always plagued by doubt about itself. You know, they were never quite sure, do we have the right to this, to that military intervention, and so on and so on. The American patriotism, how should I put it, lost its innocence. It was minimally problematized. And I think that the way the September 11th event effectively functioned was precisely as an instrument to enable the American ideology to fall asleep again. That is to say, to regain its innocence. The idea is, now we again, because we were now victims, we have the full right to reassert the innocent American patriotic innocence, and so on and so on. So this, for me, seems the tragedy of it. Why do I say the tragedy? Because when we are now allowed to sleep again, to continue our dream, many things are happening. I report of some of them in my book, which was translated in Hebrew on September 11th. No, Welcome to the Desert of the Real. For example, the consequences of this dream are we aware that slowly things are happening which would be simply unimaginable before September 11th? Like in American media, in Newsweek now, torture of prisoners became a legitimate political topic, and other things like the amount of control and so on and so on. So again, for me, let me conclude with a reference to George Lucas. Yes, Lucas of Star Wars, where although I dislike his Star Wars series because of its obvious Oriental, fake Oriental ideology, which sustains it, and Jungian background and so on, nonetheless, he said something very interesting in an interview apropos of the last film. He said that the problem of the film is how you pass from Republic to Empire. This is why I told to Tony Negri recently that, like, that Attack of the Clones is the movie counterpart to his Empire and so on. No, but my point is that he said something very interesting, Lucas, in this interview. He said that the message will not be that the Republic is crushed, defeated by the Empire, but that in fighting the evil, you become evil. His idea is that the good guys one day will awaken and said, but wait a minute, we are the bad guys. The Empire, it's us. So that's where I see the difficulty. Chesterton, my favorite Catholic apologist, says how draws attention to this paradox of lovers of freedom who, for example, hate the church so much that only to destroy the church they are ready to abandon freedom itself. Now, my idea would be that that's the danger, no? That we hate, we want to defend our Western freedoms so much that in order to crush the fundamentalists, we are even ready to sacrifice our, so that, you know, you sacrifice our freedom, so that, how should I put it, I claim that the truly dangerous course of events is this less visible course of events. It's a shift in what, following Hegel, I would call the ethical substance, what Hegel calls Sitten, Mors, the ethical substance. This not institutionalized, but how should I call it, invisible set of so-called background presuppositions, which determines what is acceptable, what is inacceptable, which is why, for example, also in Europe, so that I will not appear as only America bashing. In Europe, things are now happening which were unthinkable years ago, with Fini neo-fascists in Italy, with Haider in Austria, and so on and so on. Many of my friends say, but okay, you see, Haider is in power, nothing happened. Yes, of course, nothing happened at the official level. But what worries me is that the whole set of implicit presuppositions in Stradling, for example, if there ever was an implicit pact, symbolic, in Europe after World War II, it's that anything directly connected with fascism is out. You don't prohibit them, not necessarily, but they are out. You don't talk with them. What worries me is that not only this taboo is broken, but even more, but also that, how should I put it, apparently Habermas won against so-called Holocaust revisionists who advocated the idea, you know, Ernst Nolte and so on, that Nazis were just answering the Soviet totalitarianism, Soviet gulags, and so on and so on. Okay, but nonetheless, at a deeper level, unfortunately, I think Nolte won. Because there is now all around Europe this idea that Germans or others also suffered, for example, you know, this pressure on the Czech Republic to renounce Benes Treaty. This idea that, okay, politics was politics, but at a certain level it's equalized. And you know what I find problematic here? Here I think that if we want to be liberals, we should be at least more radical liberals. That is to say, here we have a clear example of how the rhetoric of all the marginal voices should be included, that, you know, that the scope of public debate should get wide, more wide and wide. Yes and no, I would say. Sorry, but the fact that discussing torture is today, Germans have this wonderful word, Salon fake, something which is appropriate for high discussions, or the fact that Haider's party is government party. Sorry, I don't see any expansion of democracy in this. I see a rather worrying event. So my point would have been, you know, democracy is not only inclusion, democracy is also exclusion. Here we have to be very clear, I think, that, how should I put it, tolerance as such cannot be the ultimate value. You always have the point, here we should be Leninist. You know, Lenin, this famous, vicious, usually reference to Lenin, when he says, freedom, yes, but freedom for what? To do what? For whom to do what? That would be my concluding message. Tolerance, yes, but tolerance for whom to do what? Thanks very much. Sorry, I was too long.
Thank you very much, Professor Žižek, for this very rich, interesting, provoking, passionate talk. Indeed, your last remarks quite on the mark of a question we were discussing in these series of meetings, the limits of tolerance and the notion of the intolerable, which is very difficult and crucial. It also squares with the recent Supreme Court decision in Israel now, which took rather the other way and limited the scope of the intolerable, opened up the tolerable on very, very large and thin margins. And, of course, these questions are perennially debatable. I understand we have about a quarter of an hour for discussion. So we'll take questions as they come.